Hi, and welcome to episode 3 of the Awesome Comics Podcast, the place where small press comics make one hell of a big noise. I'm your host, Vince Hunt, creator of The Red Mask from Mars and Stalkerville, and joining me again to trek through the ever-expanding world of indie comic book awesomeness are writer, artist, and creator of the ongoing superhero webcomic Vanguard, Dan Butcher.
Hello.
And our very own Big Lebowski, it's Tony Esmond.
Oh, no. Right.
Right. Now, before we get stuck into another 90 minutes of comic chat and carnage, it's our great pleasure to introduce this week's special guest. He's a pencil pusher whose work has adorned the pages of titles like The Fantastic Four, King's Watch, American Century, and The Invaders. He's even tried to better the minds of other people by teaching art at college. Education. Currently slamming eyeballs with lashings of awesomeness and generally knocking it out of the park with his work on Marvel's current Planet Hulk series, it's Mark Lamming. Hello, Mark.
Hi there. I thought you were going to introduce Jack Kirby then.
Yeah, I bigged you up. Massive style.
Yeah, we've worked on that all week.
Yeah, I've been rehearsing it all day. Mark's joining us for the duration of this show, and medical staff are on hand to deal with him and help him recover once it's all over. But before we get stuck into this week's topics, let's cut to the chase and see what we've all been reading. So, who's first? Tony?
Okay, I've been reading a book I picked up from Orbital last Wednesday, a book called Now and Then, which is by Sally Jane Thompson, if anyone knows her.
Yes, no. Yes. Is it Atomic Sheep or something like that?
That's it. Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, yay! Very, like, sort of gentle stories, really lovely sort of sharp, crisp line work. Mm. A really sort of individual. I mean, she's been about for a while now, not saying she's old or anything, but she's been about doing work for a while. But Now and Then is something I hadn't seen before. It's sort of... it's about her. It's a sort of a thinly veiled version of herself visiting a northern town and sort of floating dreamlike between the stories of old, when it was a sort of a turn of the century working town, to what it is now, and her sort of waking up from dreams and realizing that, well, you know, it is the 2000s, and it's not sort of the time back then. It's really beautiful. It's got a sort of nostalgic feel to it. It's sort of discovery of old things. The cover's a sort of picture of old cameras and old keys and hairbrushes and all this sort of thing. It's got a little bit of The Stranger in the Strange Land, a sort of an American discovering a sort of history of England, but it's still sort of beautiful, really nice stuff, really, really nice stuff.
Is it? Yeah. Do you say it's black and white or is it colour?
It's a two-colour cover with black and white interiors, yeah.
Ooh, I do A5, like a bit of two-colour.
Yeah, I do, yeah.
I think that says a lot about me. The way I reacted to that. Oh, two colour. Yeah.
You can find her at sallyjanethompson.co.uk, and on Twitter she's at Sally Thompson to look her out. Great. Yeah,
she's hugely talented. People should read that stuff. She's great.
Yeah, we went out for a bite to eat with her last year, didn't we, Mark? And she's such a nice person as well, like really, really talented. I've got a commission on my wall right in front of me here that she did for me. Yeah, really nice stuff.
Is this going to be a recurring theme, Tony, that, like, you know, you go to
me dropping names?
Yeah, and then just be like, I've actually got something here, right, on the
There's
wall.
There's another one of those coming in a minute.
You know, like, sometimes in films you get, like, the serial killer who's got loads and loads of pages all over their walls. I can imagine,
Tony like just has comic creator's hair.
Yeah.
I do.
It's like the books from Seven.
It is pubic hair, though.
It's like I told you all, didn't I? Alfie Gallagher calls me the Zelig of comics in that I'm completely untalented, but I sort of turn up everywhere.
Yeah.
I kind of like that. It's all right.
You say it with a sneer.
Yeah. He keeps just sending me DMs saying Zelig and stuff like that. Makes me laugh. Yeah, okay.
What about you, Dan? What have you been reading, Dan?
I went back and reread a kind of classic of British comics, Dragon's Claws.
Hey!
It's an ongoing joke for the show.
Now you mentioned this, right, and this could make me seem like a right dumbass, but I've never read it.
What's wrong with you?
What was that? What a reaction. I've never got that reaction from someone before. So tell me all about it, Dan, and why
it's about a 10-issue miniseries of... Dragon's Claws is the name of the team of kind of a group of players from this kind of game, which is a bit like the Running Man. And the main guy's Dragon, obviously why it's called Claws. The other four or five team members are like his claws. And you got great names: Dragon, Digit.
Sorry. How does that work?
I don't know. It works. Basically, they get put together to kind of go out into a future Britain that's all messed up and try and kind of sort it out. And it's great. It's kind of explosive artwork. Great characters, great villains. It's worth checking out. The trade paperback, I got it for £15 in Orbital. And it's like 200-300 pages. It's great read.
Did you used to read it when you were a kid then? Was it like a 2000 AD job, or was it?
They actually printed it American-sized format. Yeah,
Marvel UK, early Marvel. Well, not early Marvel UK. It's the Marvel UK stuff that then turned into like Death's Head 2 and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, so it was before Death's Head 2 then? Oh,
right. I can remember going into the newsagent near South Norwood with my mum, and that just poking out of the racks and just taking a punt on it. And yeah, there you go. That was back in the days when you didn't have a standing order. You just had to keep turning up at the newsagent every day trying to find when the next issue came out.
Was it weekly?
I think it was monthly.
But yeah, monthly, I think. Yeah.
One of those kids that went in all the time trying to find.
Because I used to, because I lived in the middle of nowhere, didn't have a comic book shop or anything like that. So, and it was very rare you'd find like a big two book of, you know, a monthly book actually in your newsagent. You know, if you found that, it was like a golden sort of gem. So I grew up with a lot of like Eagle and Battle sort of action weekly and stuff like that. Like, you know, so I know about those. I've got fond memories of like things like Storm Force, which no one knows anything about, but when I was a kid, was the best thing ever. I mean, it's basically like a poor man's Action Force, because when, like, I think Battle Comics, it used to be Battle with Action Force, and they lost the Action Force. Yeah, they lost that license. So, you know, classic comic book sort of style, let's scramble together and create another sort of replacement. Yeah, and it was like a ragtag group of heroes, and I absolutely love it. Yeah, and I've still got fondness for it, you know. I go on eBay and try and find issues of it, you know. Even though you're paying pounds now, when you look at the price tag and it was like 20p a week or something like that.
Oh yeah,
yeah. So I don't judge you, Dan, for your fondness for that.
I don't know. Perhaps it's rose tinted glasses, but I really enjoy it. It's a fun read.
Yeah. I think it was about 40p an issue or something back then. I saw some recently. At Thought Bubble, I saw some. Yeah.
It and you bought up in them. Your worst comic selection.
Yeah, you're politely calling it the shittest comic competition that we have. Dean Beattie, who does random trials, and his wife judged it last year or the year before, I can't remember now, and that one.
Really? I need to see this on the Facebook. I've got to find it.
Yeah, I've kept it, obviously, because I'm mental, but I'll find it and stick a page on. Yeah.
And because you won.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. What did you put in? I can't remember what you put in, Mark. You had
I remember finding something good. You're normally on a safe bet with some sort of 90s image.
Darker image or something like that. Yeah.
That stuff that, like, at the time, like, it was like, oh my god, this is so good, but it doesn't necessarily age well.
What was the Lobo rip-off character that Rob Liefeld did?
He probably called it something like Hobo. I don't know.
He would have had the word blood in there or claw.
Yeah, blood Lobo. Yeah.
Blood Hobo. Yeah. That sounds like a straight to DVD film.
Blood Hobo.
Sounds a bit like a film I've watched.
Or have in your collection.
Yeah.
And has in his collection.
Yeah.
Hobo with a shotgun. There's a good film.
Yeah. Rick Hauer.
Yeah, good man. Good film. Yeah.
Wow. I still haven't seen that. I know what you're talking about, but...
Yeah, it's a bit weird. It's got that bloke from Lex in it. He plays a villain in it. No one remembers Lex, do they?
Yeah, I can't remember the villain guy.
Yeah.
I just about remember Lex.
The classic uncomfortable silence that came after that.
You just heard EX and you thought I'd say something else.
Yeah. Yeah. So Dragon Claws, Dan. So you would you would recommend it?
Wholeheartedly.
Ignore Tony and Mark.
Don't be dissuaded by the cover of it. I don't want to diss the artist who's done it, but the cover is not representative of the interior art.
Would you be able to find that, like on Amazon or something like that?
Yeah, it's kind of proper release.
Because That's the problem you get with some of the older ones. I mean, like I was talking about this Stormforce comic. It's never going to be collected. Do you know what I mean? I'd love to have a collection of it, just purely for my, you know, it's almost like I want them to spend thousands of pounds putting it all together and making a collection just so I can have it and no one else will.
We bring that up. I think I mentioned this on the Down the Tubes thing. There was a series of like science fiction comics in the small commando size printed by DC Thompson. It was a kind of to rival 2000 AD or something. Starblazer, that's it.
Yep.
Yeah. And just absolutely love some of them and just can't get them. Well, it's all eBay jobs now for like silly money.
Yeah.
And Grant Morrison wrote a few as well, and I think you find
it. Yeah, he wrote loads of those.
Yeah. Under pen names, was it though? Or didn't they credit the writers? No, I can't remember.
No, they don't credit anybody on those.
Right. Okay.
I can distinctly remember reading one that was essentially The Terminator, and that was before I'd seen The Terminator, kind of like a kind of space hero like Dan Dare. Gets relentlessly pursued by kind of this huge hulking robot. And I just thought the concept was absolutely fascinating. And a lot of them
were
great.
Great stories in them, yeah. Yeah.
Right, Dragon Claws. Keep an eye out for it. If Tony and Mark don't burn all the issues before you get there. as for me, you mentioned something that, what was it, a Lovecraftian title last week, wasn't it? The Watchful Sea, wasn't it?
That was me.
And after you said Lovecraft, that sticks in my head because I'm a Lovecraft fan. So I went to my shelves and picked out a book that I haven't read for a while called Deadbeats. Which I'm sure none of you have heard of. Have you heard of it?
I don't think so.
Well,
no, I haven't either. No.
You're going to hear about it now, bitches. it's written by Chris Lackey and Chad Pfeiffer. And they're important because they do the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, which is a podcast I listen to, which is great. If you like Lovecraft or any of that kind of weird fiction, definitely check that out. Mm. And Chad is also responsible for the awesome theme tune that we use on this show.
So, oh, brilliant.
Yeah, he's a diamond bloke, and he does a bit of writing on the side as well when he's not doing all the music. And the artist for this little tome is I.N.J. Colbard. Is that how you say it?
Yeah, I think so.
Another top chap.
Yeah, a proper top chap. And of course, because it's Lovecraft, he's normally going to get his hands dirty in it. It's published by Self-Made Hero. And what the story basically is, there's in the sort of like 1920s, there's a jazz trio who get in trouble with the mob and they go on the run. And while they're on the run, they decide to take up like a job playing for what they think is the funeral of like an elderly reverend's wife. But when they get there, they find out it's actually like an elaborate cult ritual that's to raise the spirit of like some evil sorcerer, and the dead come back to life, chaos ensues, townsfolk going crazy, massive monsters, etc., etc. But it's all based, got that nice sort of 1920s sort of feel. If you've seen any of like Colbard's sort of work, because he's done, what's it, Mountains of Madness, Case of Charles Dexter Ward, you know.
Nice.
And this is got that running through it. So it's got this definite sort of, he's almost like the perfect artist to do work of that sort of 20s, 30s sort of American era. It's got such a good feel, you know, that, you know, when an artist sort of almost made for a specific period of time.
Have you seen Sherlock Holmes stuff? That's great as well.
Yeah, that's also a Self-Made Hero, isn't it? Is that Self-Made?
I'm not sure. I can see a copy on one of the shelves. I don't know if I'm going to be able to see who the publisher is, though.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's got a good sort of visual look of Sherlock Holmes, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
Yes, very good.
Yeah. It's well worth checking out. It's got snappy sort of dialogue. Great sort of dark sort of storyline running through, but with humour throughout. There's a proper sort of humour of the time. And I thoroughly enjoy. I just sort of, it's not a massive book as such. I don't know how many pages I've got it here right in front of me. Props. See, I'm properly prepared. I think it's about 100 pages, 120 pages, something like that.
Okay.
So, you know, and even though it starts off being, you know, quite a lot of character sort of setup, when it gets rolling, you know, you're flying through these pages because you just caught up in the action, you know. So I thoroughly enjoyed rereading that again. So, you can get it on Amazon. So look up Deadbeats by Chris Lackey, Chad Pfeiffer, and INJ Colbard. Is that? Do you call him Ian or is it INJ? You know, I don't want to muck up his name.
Is Ian.
Ian Colbard.
They call him Inge Colbard.
Inge Colbard.
Inch High Private Eye, that's what they call him. Which is funny because he is the tallest man in the world.
Is he an imposing man? Is he a scary man? I just
want
to know.
He's a large figure of a man.
Will he loom over me when he tells me that I'd said his name wrong and I then soil my undergarments?
Yes, apparently he'll also chew like a fly.
Undergarments? Well, you're a fucking Victorian lady.
Look,
he's challenging the bushes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it gets to you that much. You actually you move back in time.
Yeah, go turn into a lady. Apparently.
I don't know where you got the lady bit from. This podcast isn't visual. You can't see this. You've got no proof. Yeah, so check it out. Look it up on Amazon, and I'll put a link on the show notes, etc. But Mark, what have you been reading?
Well, I've been reading something again, rather than something from the past from this week, because everything seems to be Marvel and Secret Wars. So I thought something different from that. It's a book by a guy called Ted Mathot, who's an illustrator and animator for Pixar. And the book's called Korra. It's very, very good. it's set in the 1880s, and it's a sequel to a book that he'd done previously called Rose and Isabel, which is about two sisters who during the Civil War go to rescue their brothers who have been caught and are prisoners of war in a terrible prisoner of war Confederate prisoner of war camp. And the story kind of takes up 20 years later in Korra. It's a sort of family mystery with a real feel of something like 3:10 to Yuma or The Unforgiven about it. But it's a female cast. The artwork, because, you know, it's somebody who works for Pixar, is, of course, awesome.
Has it got that sort of Pixar feel to it? Is it, you know, is it?
Yeah, I mean, if you think Brave rather than Toy Story.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. But the artwork's just beautiful.
It's interesting, because as soon as you said Korra, I don't know why, I immediately thought of sci-fi. I don't know. So when you started describing the story, I was like, oh, you know, it's just... It totally wasn't what I thought it was going to be, just from the name. It shows you how much a name can sort of colour your view of things, really. Mm. Yeah,
absolutely. Sorry, what was that, Tony?
Who's putting it out?
It's self-published by Ted himself, and you can get it from his blog, which is roseandisabel.blogspot.co.uk.
Right.
Brilliant. Okay. .co.uk, so he's a UK...
Well, it's come up as that, and I don't think he is from the UK, but if he is, brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, I found him when I was sort of stalking everybody who worked for Pixar, just to see what they did on their weekends, but, you know, the work's beautiful.
It's interesting, like with Pixar, because you're so used to the films, but there's such a massive pool of talent at Pixar.
And all those guys want to be comic book artists until they find out how much they don't get paid.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether he is Pixar, but the animator sort of style that I always think of is Mike Kunkel, who did Hero Bear and the Kid. Have you seen
that?
I think he was a Disney animator, wasn't he?
He was, I think.
Yeah, and you can tell that as soon as you look at it, you think, well, that looks like a cartoon sort of come to life. But
when you were stalking these people online, did you?
I got arrested. Yes.
Yeah. One, were you naked? And two, did you ask them how they got weekends? Because you don't get weekends, do you? No proper artist gets weekends, do they?
No, that's because they work for big companies that
sell outs.
Yeah. they do jobs where somebody else can do their job as well.
Yeah. They get computers to draw the comics, don't they? Is that how it works? I don't understand.
Oh, completely. They just turn up and talk at a computer and then does what they want.
Yeah. just imagine that. I get so much more work done if that was the case.
No, you'd still be on Tumblr.
True. You're a busy man at the moment, aren't you, Mark? You're doing some small indie book. I don't know what was it. What's it called? Plane 8 Hulk? Hulk? Hack? What's it called?
Planet Hacky.
Yeah, you know, Planet Hack. That's it. Planet Hack.
How much would you put in a day? I know there's no such.
You don't want to know what the length of my day is. It's a 16-hour day isn't unusual.
Really? Okay, that's a hell of a lot.
I mean, I must say, whenever I look at your Twitter feed, like the sort of like the sketches or the pencils or like, you know, it's fairly constant throughout. It's like you're a 24-hour machine, you know.
Yeah, well, there's 5 hours sleep in between those. So where it looks like I'm just having lunch or something, that's sleep.
Do you ink your stuff as well, Mark?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Do you want to talk us a bit through your process, Mark? It might be quite interesting because a lot of people aren't digital. You've gone digital, what, year or so ago, is that right?
I'm trying to think, when did I go digital? I went digital at the end of doing the Splinter Cell book, so that was almost 2 years ago now.
Right.
What else did I do digital before that? Splinter Cell, then it was... Oh, King's Watch was all digital.
Right, okay. How did you find the change? How did you find the change?
I didn't really notice it. It took round about the same amount of time, but the reason I'd gone digital was that there were so many changes required on the Splinter Cell book because it was a licensed video game book.
Right.
And as they were finishing the game, they were changing the way characters looked and things like that. So it was becoming frustrating that something you'd drawn 3 months ago at the beginning of the book, it's like, oh, can you just make a change? And it'd be like 8 pages of changes that you needed to do. And it was...
Really?
Well, he's now a male character.
Didn't you get told to shorten a knife or something? Was that? I remember that.
Oh, no, lengthening knives and shortening knives and changing the gun because they've changed the gun and things like that.
Digital must make such a difference when it comes to things like that.
Oh, yeah, because you just don't cry. You know, when you finish the page and it's put to bed, you know, one, you don't ever want to look at it again because, you know, you've got another page to draw.
Yeah.
And you always have, like, the thing of, like, is it finished? Is it finished? Yes, it's finished. It's good enough to go to print.
Yeah.
You know, that debate with yourself when you finish a page.
Right.
And, you know, when you can't really make a change without cutting the panels out or pasting them in and stuff like that, it's really frustrating when somebody wants a change. That's one of those, like, let me go for a walk and I'll come back and then do it because, you know, I'll just wreck the house otherwise.
One issue someone raised, an artist, about doing it all digital is the fact you don't have, like with original pages, you could sell them on for some money. I don't know how it works with the kind of the bigger guys with Marvel, like, do they own those rights to the page or whatever?
Oh, no, well, they own the work, but not the physical artwork.
Okay.
Well, you can do that, and do you know what? And up until sort of 3 months ago, I had no one knocking my door down for original artwork.
Mm.
So it's not been...
That surprises me.
That's not an issue. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that does surprise me.
Well, people were more interested in getting, you know, a commission, so something for them, rather than a page from a book that they don't particularly care about, if you see what I mean.
Mm.
Yeah, have you found that, like, the request for commissions and stuff, has that, like, shot through the roof, like, with Planet Hulk?
You know? Yeah, well, I've had a lot more people sort of saying, when you put your next list up, please can I be on it? I mean, when you're trying to get a book out on a monthly schedule, there's just no time to do commissions. Okay. But it's nice when you get a break because you can go, right, I can fill my time and keep my bank balance going with commissions.
So it's like, oh, finally, I don't have to draw. I know what, I'll do some more drawing. That's what always gets me. Like when I see artists going, oh, I've done a warm up, and you see this amazing sort of coloured picture, and then they have a day of art, and they go, oh, I'll just do a warm down sketch, and it's not. I'm sorry, it's not a sketch. It's frankly not a sketch.
I always think that. You know, they always say warm up and warm down, don't they? And you see, I saw Christian Wildgoose tube on the other day. I thought, how long did that take you to do?
Well, you know, if it's Christian, it took him a whole day.
Probably, yeah.
What is the definition of a sketch? As in, is there a time thing for it? Because some people say, oh, is this sketch of not duff? And it's like, you spent ages labouring over that. For me, a sketch is like you knock out on a scrap of paper.
Oh, don't ask him. He takes hours. He does the most detailed convention sketches I've ever seen.
Unless I tell somebody it's going to be a sketch and then they get that sketch for nothing.
Right, okay.
If they're paying good money, then I think they should have a good piece of artwork. But if somebody sort of just wants like a small head sketch or something, then that's the sort of thing you do and give away.
Okay.
And if they're really rude, then you just draw a crude picture of a phallus.
Yes. Yeah. Well, no, actually, what I do is I get Tony.
That's what I'm doing now.
So, Mark, you kind of your setup for working at home, is it like you do in Photoshop or in Manga Studio? Or
yeah, I'm a complete Luddite. I don't use Manga Studio because it would mean learning a new program, which would just drive me mad. So I use Photoshop, which I've been using for 20 plus years.
I guess it's the downtime as well. You'd have to spend learning Manga Studio. Can you afford to do that?
Precisely. I needed to be able to hit the ground running. So, you know, so that you don't feel like you're learning as you go, which is an awful situation to be in because, you know, if something goes wrong, you know, that could be 2 or 3 days you've lost of your schedule just to...
And you can't afford to lose that time, can you? Especially with the sort of like the schedules that the Marvel books are on.
No, well, yeah, you really can't. You know, especially if you want to sort of have a day off.
Yeah, you know, day off.
Yes.
Yeah, but you end up working on your day off. Everyone does that, don't they?
Oh yeah. You know what I mean? But you know, it's that thing where you go out and you get to, you know, quite often meet up with Tony on a Saturday or something, but it's that time away from the studio.
You wake up the next day in a ditch, covered in someone else's blood.
Not blood, my friend.
With bears, normally, as well, which is very strange.
Right, I'll tell the bear story one day. I'll tell it one day.
So, Mark, would you kind of like, you'd get the script from the editor, I presume, and would you thumbnail the entire issue and then kind of get that approved? Or
yeah, what I tend to do is my thumbnail process I do on tiny little post-it notes and do what, you know, the square ones rather than the big, large ones. So the smallest you can get. Draw those up on there so that I can't get fussy in any shape or form with what I'm doing. So it's really about, you know, the composition between the panels and how they work on the page. I tend to do sort of 10 of those at a time, then go to a sheet of A4 paper and then do 6x9 centimeter pencils, which are really just like elaborate layouts. Those then get scanned in and I then blow those up and then just ink straight over the top of those.
Okay.
So it cuts out a lot of the penciling process that you would have done on paper.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it means you can do corrections and so, you know, obviously on the layout stage on A4, you're still not putting in an awful lot of detail. So I'll pencil on a layer below where the inks are going to be faces and things like that. But most of the anatomy and the poses and everything is kind of captured in the layout anyway.
Okay, so you're looking more for the sort of flow of the book, flow of the images between each other.
Yeah, absolutely.
In the layout, and then the detail goes on to the digital, I suppose. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Have you ever anyone offered to buy your post-it notes?
Not the post-it notes.
Give it time.
No, those just get. I literally throw those away.
Oh.
But the
bins. I know where his bins are.
brilliant.
And he has been through them.
Oh dear, where do we take it from there?
How's your relationship with, because you're writing with Sam Humphreys at the moment, aren't you?
Yes,
how does that, would you mind talking us through the process for that? I mean, is there a conversation first, you know?
Well, not really. It's an odd one. Your working relationship sort of builds as you go, because it's very much the editor says, right, okay, I've got this project. Are you interested in it? You say yes or you say no. And normally you're saying, yes, please give me some work. So you start working with them. And as the work's getting put, you know, you're pushing the pages backwards and forwards, you start talking, you know, via email. And that tends to be how the working relationship works.
Right.
And Sam's great to work with. He's very open. We do... Or on the majority of the book, there's been at least 5 or 6 pages which have been Marvel style, meaning that he's just given me a breakdown of what happens, and then I go away and let out. So it's been a very collaborative kind of way of working.
Do you guys know what Marvel style is? Not,
I'm familiar.
Yeah, okay.
But for the listeners, Tony,
okay,
tell them.
Well, so Marvel style is basically, it comes from Stan, doesn't it, I think, if I'm saying that. So it comes from Stan in the 60s and early 70s, where he would tell an artist what the story would be. The artist would flesh out the pages.
They'd go away and do the breakdown. Yeah, so he'd just say, right, Spider-Man meets the Green Goblin and he has an argument with Mary Jane. Go away, draw that up, make it exciting, and I'll then dialogue it.
Yeah, and then it comes back to him, then he fills in the dialogue sort of thing. So sometimes back in the day with Stan, it would be a conversation as opposed to, or sometimes it would be actually written down, wouldn't it? So this page,
I think most of it was actually just conversation. It was a phone call, or the artist, because they all lived in New York, would come into the office. They have a story conference. I mean, there's lots of stories about Kirby and Jack. Kirby and Lee working together, where Lee would get the pages and go, "Jack forgot everything I told him." Which probably meant actually Stan, your story was a bunch of crap and Jack's done something really good.
Yeah.
Or a certain writer we can't name, Mark Miller, who would write fight scene, you know, four page fight scene, you know.
Have you seen some of the stuff by is it Alan Grant? And it's, I think it's Alan Grant, and it's just like a huge rambling page of text, and it's like, okay, now you've got to make a page out of that.
I know
Alan Moore.
So his page is like super detailed. Like, this is what the doorknob looks like and all this sort of thing. And then the artist just ignores it and just, does the main bits. I think Dave Gibbons said he would highlight sections, wouldn't he? He'd highlight what needed to be put in when he got the pages through on the fax machine when they were doing Watchmen. Yeah.
That must be really difficult to work like that. I mean, because you're trying to make a kind of call as to what's relevant and what's not. And you really got to try and get inside the writer's head.
Yeah.
And you don't know where they're going with it. I mean, they might call back to that doorknob like two issues later, and it's like, oh, I didn't add that detail.
It's interesting you talk about the thumbnail sort of method, because it's something that I know I do. I don't know whether you do, Dan. When I'm writing like Red Mask and stuff, I thumbnail, like, I make like little mock-ups of the entire issue, I can paste like the the action, and then I sort of write a script from that. How do you do it, Dan? Do you do it?
Pretty much the same. I mean, I've kind of do those rough little thumbnails. I've got a couple on the site actually where I've posted the thumbnail and the finished page next to it as kind of comparison to see how close they were. Yeah. And it's another bit of content for people to kind of see what you're getting up to, really.
Yeah.
Okay. But very much kind of script in shorthand and then kind of flesh it out as you go along.
Yeah.
I think it's the most important part of the process, because one, you're designing the book. And two, you know, it's where, you know, the rest of it's knitting, you know, doing the drawing and the inking and everything. That's all stuff it's kind of labor intensive, whereas the layouts and thumbnailing is really where you do the actual work of making a comic, I think.
Yeah, especially when it's very action orientated. You've got to get the sort of rhythm of like the action going right through the whole thing, because like I'm writing my stuff with a view to I'm going to collect it at some point. And when I collect it, it's not going to have like chapter breaks. It's not going to have cover breaks or whatever. I want the story to flow in one thing. So the beginning of issue two, I want it to work with the last page you see on issue one. So by having these little mock-ups, I can see, I mean, they're a tiny sort of scale, but I can see how the rhythm of the story continues with each, you know. And once I'm like happy with that, and then I'll script it up and write in like the cliffhangers and and people blowing up, etc.
You mentioned that thing about doing a thumbnail and then blow it up. Like, and everyone knows I'm a big fan of Ryan Ottley. He does exactly the same thing, keeps the energy really small on a little sketch and then blows it up and then works over the top.
It was interesting. Okay. I saw on YouTube Gavin Mitchell, artist of like the Pride and what was it? Stiffs, that's what we're talking about. He recently posted a video on YouTube of his sort of method, and he works digital. And it's like a 7-minute video that's all like sped up, and you're just looking at what he's doing for this page of the Trolltooth Wars. And it's fascinating. I mean, I mean, it's probably similar to what you do, Mark. Like, you know, putting things in, there's pictures sort of behind that he can use as, like, reference, or, like, he can do the angles, or he's sketched something. The eyes aren't quite right, and you're seeing the eyes sort of rotate a little bit and shrink down because, I mean, I've done it before, that sometimes you draw something and it's like, oh, my God, that bit isn't quite in scale.
Oh, God, it's the best bit. I think everybody draws eyes too small and probably in the wrong place or too close together. And I probably spend more time just shifting those gently about a little tiny bit than anything else.
A quick question. Do you start with the eyes? Well, normally when I draw like a head, sometimes I will start with the eyes and nose. I don't know why.
No, always. It's the... because John Buscema told me how to do it in...
Tell me.
I always start with an egg. You know, it's just, you know, and then... And then build the features from there, you know, or that rough shape for the head.
Yeah, I always go from a skull, kind of like a rough skull shape, and then the body will follow and whatever.
Is the face almost like the last thing you put on then? Sometimes. Is that what you would say? You put like the egg or the skull, and then you put the hair and the detail, and then the face is the last.
Yeah, because I've probably indicated with the cross where the eyes and nose are.
I always have to shrink the heads down on my characters because I always, most of the time, draw the heads too small. And so I have to blow them up and say, oh my God, that looks awful.
Are you using a reference, Dan? Do you have a small head in real life? Is that what it is? Are you like one of those shrunken head characters from Beetlejuice?
Weirdly, I have an enormous head, so I have to do it the other way around.
A lot of my work colleagues would accuse me of having a big head. But no, it's pretty regular sized, to be honest.
Mine's like a melon.
Your head,
Easy now.
The tone's dropping with every episode. Mark, have you ever written something for yourself?
Oh, God, not since I was at school. No, I'd soon learnt that storytelling was visually what I did best rather than writing stories myself.
So when you started on your long journey to where you are now, you know, was it I'm guessing, did you just find like friends and stuff who were writing things and then got together like that?
Let's see. Well, I mean, stuff I did at school, you know, very very early stuff. That photocopied stuff that, you know, the one teacher who just like when he's not do anything if he doesn't do comics. You know, took you into the photocopy room and photocopy these, sell them to your friends, shut up, you know, one of those ones, and then slapped you around the head as you walked out. You know, so that stuff was all written by me, and those are dreadful. And then when I was at college, I did write some really pretentious rubbish.
Days when you want to just change the world.
Yeah, well, I mean, this was like, you know, really bad sort of epic stroke heavy metal stuff where it's, you know, you think you're being really incredibly insightful about the human condition. And basically, you know, it's worse than sick form poetry. I soon realised that wasn't going to work for me. So I started adapting books that I liked. So I did a few pages from The Hitchhiker's Guide. And I also did most of The Wasp Factory by Ian Banks. Which got me my first work with Eclipse straight out of college. So, which was with a guy called David Thorpe, who was the guy who relaunched Captain Britain before Alan Moore got his hands on him.
Okay.
Because he happened to have come to my end of year show, seen the work, and it. But unfortunately, that book never came out. That was one of those things where we spent ages doing this fully painted book. And it was one of the many disappointments that I had at the beginning of my comics career, which was kind of like, oh, you start this, it'll be brilliant. And then company after company was going bust.
What was that called, Mark?
Well, the David Thorpe thing that didn't happen.
The Eclipsing, yeah.
Yeah, that was called The Gene Police. He's since turned it into a novel.
Oh, okay. Okay. Right. Interesting. So what was your work after that? Where did you go after that?
After that, because I needed to have some money coming in, I started working in a comic shop in East Barnet. And then started touting work around to people like it was DC London then and 2000 AD, and I ended up getting on very well with Peter Hogan at Revolver and getting some work with him. So I did a whole load of stuff for the inventory draw, you know, the stuff just in case they'd pull out and and use. And one of those things ended up being published in the last thing that Revolver did, which was their romance special.
Okay. And he's the guy who does Resident Alien now.
He did Love Street, the Hellblazer book for Vertigo, and loads of other stuff.
Right, cool.
But, and then from there...
This is your life, isn't it, this episode?
Yeah, it really is.
It's supposed to be warming him up to tell you the story about the cosplayer.
Yes. we can get to that one.
Okay.
But, you know, do settle in because this goes on forever. but cut a long story short, because Revolver went bust, I went off and had a massive sulk about comics for 4 years. Didn't do anything, went and played in bands and things like that and ran a recording studio. And then realised one day that actually what I wanted to do was draw comics, and phoned up my friend Martin, who I'd worked with at the comic shop in East Barnet. And he said, oh, I've got some ideas. We'll get together and we'll do some self-published stuff. And this was when Dave Sim from Cerebus was encouraging everybody to self-publish, and we thought it would be a brilliant idea and we'd make millions. So we...
I'm guessing you didn't.
No.
Yeah,
he did.
But off the back of the work I did with Martin, I ended up getting work at Vertigo. So,
and Martin's still in a comic shop, isn't he? Where he does various things. Oh, no, he's just left, isn't he?
He has just left.
Krypton Comics in Black Horse Lane in London. Great, the best back issue. Sorry,
I was up there the other week.
Oh, were you? Okay.
Yeah. It's a great shop.
Best back issues in London, I think. Definitely.
What a claim!
Yeah.
What was that book called then, Mark? You know, the book that essentially got you the foot in Vertigo.
Well, that was called Six Degrees, which was, I suppose, it was like, how would I describe it? It was a thriller sort of crime book that was pretending to be a conspiracy book, but it wasn't. You know, the whole idea was that there was supposed to be this big conspiracy, but like all conspiracies, they don't exist. You know, so it was somebody's mad delusion that he thought there was this big conspiracy going on, but there wasn't. It just it was just life's like that kind of thing. And then we did our version of Preacher, which was basically just loads of exploding heads and people getting killed in horrible ways.
Yes,
ultra-violent book.
Yes,
called Gaia, which was lasted for a whole three issues because it was like, well, we've exploded all the heads. what else can we do? And we were sitting there going, there might be some more story there, but I really don't think there is.
Yeah, I mean, that you say that was three issues. You know, when you're self-publishing and stuff, that's quite a feat, really. You know,
yeah. I think we were doing a bi-monthly schedule on that as well, and of course, we were both working as well.
Yeah,
that's really cranking it out then, bi-monthly. Yeah. So well, you're working full time and then doing that in your downtime.
Yeah, it seems terribly slow now.
Yeah, cause, I mean, when you're doing that, I mean, the small press, like everyone's got like they can get to a printer or something like that. But when you're doing that, how were you getting the books out? Because there's no digital or anything like that then, was there?
No, we were using the same printers that Paul Grist was using. I mean, at the time it was quite good because there was... you had people like Paul and Paul Rainey and Gary Spencer Millage, and we all pulled sort of our information, and it was very much kind of, you know, this is where the best place to get print stuff printed. Mm. I mean, Gary, I think in the end was getting his stuff printed in America and sent back to here for the English orders because it worked out ridiculously, you know, the better value for him.
Yeah. Was that when he was on Strangehaven?
That was on Strangehaven.
Okay.
No, that's before Chris Staros took over helping him out with that. That was when he was properly self-publishing it.
Okay. Which is now back, isn't it? It's at Meanwhile, I think.
Yeah.
It's come back again. Yeah.
That's bonkers, getting stuff printed in the States and getting it shipped back. That's cheaper than getting it printed in the UK.
Yeah, you see,
people are doing that with Poland now. I mean, stuff is getting sent to Poland and China and stuff now, isn't it? And coming back from there.
Yeah, I've heard Jamie Lambert, the writer of. Have you ever heard a comic called Dexter's Half Dozen? You might have seen it on your travels.
I've not read it though. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a World War, a supernatural World War II book. I think they're up to about issue 8. But the first two issues, they did exactly the same thing. And he said to me, you know, they got them for such a steal. You know, they managed to get more printed. And, you know, they got it at just the right time, you know, when the conversion rate was just right, you know. So, but yeah, I can't imagine doing it now. I can't, you know, how would you do it now?
Mm.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, back then it was also that Diamond were allowing books in with much lower numbers than they are now. So just, you know, what you could do was ship your books direct from a printer in the States like Preeny and go straight to a Diamond warehouse, and Diamond would then do all your distribution for you.
Brilliant.
So, I mean, that was quite useful. But then they ended up sort of taking a huge cut eventually, and so it became less and less viable.
Right.
I mean, yes. Diamond, I mean, I remember, like, when I was a kid, I always go back when I was a lad. I used to get previews and go through all that, you know. And it used to be one of the things. Oh, when I make a comic and it's in previews, I'll know I've made it. You know, that kind of dream. Yeah. But yeah. Previews now, would you say it's less of a thing now that we've got the internet and everyone self promotes and you've got websites, and you know, how important do you think something like that is to the small press sort of market?
I don't think it is at all now. I think the internet does that all for you.
And it's more.
I mean, back when email was first sort of like becoming something that people used, I can remember sending emails to shops in the States and over here and being accused of sending them junk mail at that point, you know, rather than sort of help, you know, back when people thought that, you know, only your friend should send you an email.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
I still think that now, to be honest.
I don't have any friends, so it's difficult.
Yours are marked to junk, so I never see yours, Tony. Don't worry about that.
Yeah. Mine are about Russian brides. I send them on to you, but you never read them.
Oh, God. Where were we?
Talking about printing.
Yeah, and stuff. Diamond.
Yeah. Diamond, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I don't think they're as important. I think that it's with things like Kickstarters and, you know, the internet and being able to, you know, I mean, you can even do print on demand with a lot of places now. So you don't even have to do the physical printing on that stuff. That just arrives at somebody's house.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So the days of having big boxes of comics in you, which I'm sitting here looking at a box of mine from 1997, have long gone almost, haven't they? That'll be the way it is soon.
What are you going to do with those, Tony? Come on.
I'm going to send them to you, mate. You can have some.
I think I've still got a box of Paul Rainey's comics upstairs from a show we did many years ago.
Yeah.
when you did that sort of smaller stuff then, Mark, did you, yeah. I mean, how did you get it out there? Did you go, you know, did you find local conventions or, you know, what was it like?
Well, there was only really UCAC and Bristol, and there was no point in doing the comic marts in London because no one would look at what you had because they were desperately after chromium covered X-Men books. So most of it, the way Martin and I promoted was we'd go to San Diego once a year and we'd do the retail. There used to be a retailers week before the actual convention. So it'd be all the big retailers would get together and they'd have all of the presentations from the big companies about what they were going to be doing for the next year. And we'd just go along to those, go to the mixers, meet the people and hand out ash cans and stuff like that. And that was really how we got decent sales.
No.
Nice.
It's so much easier now with the, well, not easy. I'm not saying it's easy, but it's so much changed, isn't it? Well, you know, Twitter followers are the equivalent of going to San Diego, you know, it's sort of...
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, Twitter follows is the equivalent of getting a table and slogging your way through a weekend at Bristol, you know, it's sort of... Yeah, it's a really changed world, isn't it, you know?
But
what's the kind of... I'd say the relationship between kind of your social media presence and being there at a table, meeting people face-to-face?
Yeah.
I mean, presumably you'd generate a lot more kind of... connections with people when you're interacting face to face as opposed to over social media. I don't know.
I think you do, but I think a lot of it is done with other small press guys, you know. You go to Bristol and then you'd all buy each other's books, you know, and you'd all know the guy who wouldn't buy yours, you know, and this sort of thing. It was very much sort of swapping.
Yeah, and you'd all get him drunk and then shave his eyebrows off in the bar.
Yeah.
That happened, so.
Okay.
I think the difference with Bristol is I remember you would get people from, I remember some lady from Disney coming past our table when I had a table there. Ed, who we were talking about earlier, before the program started, him basically pitching her his work at the table, and she come all the way from the States to see sort of British talent at Bristol, you know. So yeah, I think there was a bit of that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, I first met, or was introduced to Shelley Bond, who was Shelley Roberg back then, from Vertigo by Andy Lanning, who the only reason he was talking to me at the time was because we had a similar surname.
Yeah.
You know, you've got a similar surname to mine.
Where was that? UCAC then, Mark?
That was at Bristol.
Oh, okay. Right.
And Shelley, I think, had just got it together with Philip Bond at that point and wasn't really interested in seeing anybody's work. And it was kind of like, oh, send me some stuff in the mail. Here's my card. So I did. And then sort of 3 weeks later, I got a call and I was then working with Howard Chaykin.
Awesome.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
That's the whole story.
Yeah.
Give him but, the This Is Your Life book and that, let's just push him off.
He's got a lovely voice, Nick. That was lovely.
Yeah, that was beautiful.
Thank you.
There's Mariah Carey, then there's Dan Butcher.
I'm just waiting for the "you haven't seen him in years."
and you owe them money.
But I mean, you dipped out, didn't you, Mark?
I dipped out after I ended my go on American Century and went off and taught for 6 years.
Right.
And then decided that teaching really wasn't as much fun as it used to be, and found that I was drawing again.
Wasn't your first project a small? It's Shepperton's Waltz. Is that right? Is that the name of it?
Yeah.
That was a sort of...
Well, actually, no, the first thing I did straight afterwards was an inking job for somebody. I think you met the guys, the Doozy Girl, the zombie book.
Oh, New York, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
I think I've been talking to him on an old internet message board called Drawing Board, and it was like, dude, I really need to finish this book. Please, please, can you ink it for me? And it was like, well, yeah, all right, if you don't mind. So I did that and realised that I quite enjoyed it and how quick it actually was in comparison to how long it had felt. Because American Century, it just felt like it took me forever to do a page.
Right.
Mm.
Is that what led you to sort of like have the hiatus? You just, you know, it felt more...
Oh, no, that was my dad was ill and the idea of putting together a monthly comic book was becoming less and less important than spending time with my dad.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, the only problem with comics is you just don't see people.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there are bigger priorities in the world sometimes, aren't there?
So. Yes, I mean, that was what happened. And it, you know, and then I got offered this Shepperton's Waltz thing, which was like a sci-fi Western graphic novel. And off the back of some of the pages from that, I got a book with Boom called The Rents, which is
now optioned, isn't it? Is it a TV series or a movie? Or
I think it's a TV series they're looking at doing with it.
Boom have a lot of things that are optioned, don't they? Boom seem to be their sort of like, they're almost like the new IDW of things like being optioned everywhere.
Hmm.
Yeah. All
I mean, they're a great company for starting out with. They're incredibly loyal and they've got some great ideas and very open to good ideas. You know, they're the sort of company you work for when you're working part time.
Right. Okay. Right. Yeah, interesting.
You know, just because their page rates aren't enormous, but if the point I was working for them, I think I was teaching 3 days a week, so it was I had 4 days to draw comics in, so it was, you know, feasible to do a monthly comic book. Mm.
Yeah, and that's a sort of noir crime book, isn't it, The Rinse?
Yeah, it's a book about money laundering.
Right. Okay.
Nice.
It's a really good story. It was a really nice one to come back with. And then from that, I ended up working with Gabriel Hardman on A Planet of the Apes book. And that was great because I just love Gabriel's work anyway. And he and his wife were writing that, so it's even better.
And it was onwards and upwards from there. And now you're drawing big green things and
bashing up dinosaurs.
Yeah. How can anyone not want to buy that book? Just from that alone, you don't even need the title.
No, well, I mean...
We call ourselves the Dinosaur Podcast. That's the second week we've had dinosaurs.
I know. Yeah.
You probably get great readership as well. People love a dinosaur.
They do love dinosaurs. Yeah. Like Barney, the pink dinosaur, which is what I call my private parts.
Right. I think you'll find it's purple and not your private parts, but Barney. I hate to be specific, but Barney was purple.
I'd like to get this in that Vince has never seen my private parts.
Don't start that with, I'd like to get this in.
Tony, have you ever looked at your private parts and thought, you know what, I might kill myself?
Funny you should mention that, Dan, but yeah, I'm not proud of it. I have thought about killing myself, yeah. I've sat there with a barrel in my mouth, you know, as you do, you know, and a bottle of whiskey, and I thought... I can't go through with it. You know, I just can't go through with killing myself. But if you really want to go through with it and pull the trigger, why not listen to the Trash Compactor podcast? Available on iTunes.
Set up, delivered.
I tell you what,
like last week. Fucking brilliant.
We knocked that out of the fucking park.
That was class.
Yeah, that worked. Yeah. Yeah.
The thing is, he's been sat there for 5 minutes thinking, when can I do it? When can I do it? When can I do it?
That popped up. I was like, this is the time.
Yeah, and you can't... Oh, dear.
Yes.
Okay. So, Mark, obviously you're at like a lot of conventions and stuff. Do you get a chance to like walk around and see a lot of the small press? What from the small press stuff sort of like have you picked up or you're following and stuff?
Let's see. Well, I kind of have to go and buy everything that... Warwick Cadwell does. That stuff's just wonderful. Robert Ball's stuff I really love. Then if I don't buy anything that Paul Rainey's doing, he ends up killing me, so I have to buy that.
Community.
Yeah, well, I've known Paul for such a long time, it's ridiculous. It was one of those odd ones where we found out, because we both come from the same town, but didn't know this when we first met, that he was the person who used to get into the newsagent before me and get the X-Men before me.
No, that bastard.
He had been my nemesis and ended up being my mate.
And also Porcelain.
Yes, absolutely. All the improper book stuff's really good.
Yeah.
Love Porcelain. That is one of the... Yeah, such a amazing... Have they released the second one? Porcelain yet, or is it?
No, they've just done the preview book. I think it's coming out at Thought Bubble this year.
Yes, I think so.
Because
they've got a French publisher now. I think it's all down to when they're publishing stuff to when they can then publish things.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, well, was the first one just all off their own backs then? Was that?
Yes, it was. But there is a Delcourt version of it as well. Which is a beautiful, big hardback, you know, sort of album-sized rather than the tiny book. Because, I mean, the one thing when you look at Porcelain, you just go, this is too small. Surely this needs to be enormous size.
We've all had that.
Barney?
Yeah. I mean, to anyone listening, like, if you've never heard of Porcelain, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
Check that out. Yeah. It's Christian Wild Goose and who's...
It's Ben
Reed, is it?
Reed, yeah.
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 Such a beautiful story. I don't often use the word beautiful because I don't have that kind of vocabulary. Although I managed to use beautiful and vocabulary in the same sentence. So
yeah, this one's a new one to me, so I'm gonna write this down.
Oh mate, definitely, yeah. I'll get one sent to you. It's lovely. It's big things in the works for Chris, I think, definitely.
Oh yeah, I mean I think the first show he ever did, he ended up impressing Kieran Gillen so much that Kieran was like, I want him on the X-Men.
Yeah. Was that Kapow? Was that the second Kapow?
No, that was a Demon Con.
Oh, okay. All right.
One of the really early Demon Cons.
Yeah, I think I met him at Kapow, and he had the black and white sort of preview copy of the first Porcelain book out then. It was lovely. I've got a signed copy.
That was at the second one, wasn't it?
That's right. Yeah. The last one, essentially. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, which is a shame. Did either of you two guys go to Kapow?
No. I always wanted to, but...
Really good. I really liked it.
Was it 1 year or 2 years? Was it going for 2 years, or was it just one?
Ran for 2 years, yeah. Mm. Yeah. But great venue, like loads of sort of local pubs that filled up with comic fans. It's good. Good venue. Good event, yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah, definitely. Did we want to talk a bit about Comic-Cons? Because obviously it's London Film and...
Yeah,
I'm on this weekend, isn't it? Yeah.
I think that's a good segue for that, because it's London Film and Comic Con's been an interesting one, because I've been hearing sort of mixed reviews from the small press community. Not necessarily, I'm not saying the event's bad whatsoever. I've never been the one, and I'm sure if I went there, I'd be like a kid at Christmas, because it's just, you know, the sort of stuff you love, isn't it? But it brings up an interesting debate of how small press is at these sort of shows. Because sometimes they're tucked away, or they're not signposted properly, or you know, they're one place on one day and then they're having to be moved the next day. I mean, what do you guys feel about? Because I come from like the middle of nowhere, I've hardly been to a lot of these shows. I'd like to get to like MCMs and stuff like that. But what do you think the attitude towards small press is at these bigger shows?
Yeah, I think MCM is learning. I think they've definitely really improved. I haven't been going to them for a few years now. Comic Village at MCM used to be almost, you couldn't find it. It was just a couple of rows of tables. And
it was
you weren't
a bit,
really
bit
sure.
of a ghetto, wasn't it?
It was a bit, yeah. But these days, I have to say, I mean, I will agree with most people's criticism of MCM that it's, you know, it's all about, you know, big films and manga and, you know, cosplay and stuff. But I think the Comic Village is quite thriving at these places, and I think people do quite well at them.
I have heard that. Whenever, you know, people sort of say MCM, it's full on. You know, there's so many people everywhere, but not one person has sort of said, "I haven't done very well at these shows." It's always been like, yeah, it's, you know, it's sort of less interaction, but more just sort of like, you know, just people just picking up everything and just grabbing your stuff, which is good, which is why I need to get there to get rid of some of my comics.
There's a couple of artists that I know that sold their book there, and they did very well, and they were getting commission work selling their stuff. It was, they did well.
Because of the growth of small press now, though, when you're on that MCM like registration list, you have to be like a hawk for that email that sort of says, book your table. Because if you don't get it within 30 minutes, it's gone. Do you know what I mean? And if you're working in the day and you don't check your email till later, that you'll get there. You'll get there. We'll put you on the waiting list. But you know, that's why I missed.
I tried for like 2 years running trying to get a table there, and it just wasn't happening. Like it literally, like an hour after the tweet had said, "Oh, the tables are open," it was you're done. There's none left.
Vince, didn't I put you in contact? Was it you I put in contact with someone for a table last year? I can't remember.
Yes. I couldn't make it in the end. But
Okay. Yeah. I think sharing a table is almost the way ahead, knowing someone who's going to be there who grabs a table, you know?
Yeah. What do you mean, like, if someone grabs a whole table and then they've got, like, another half available? Is that
then you can sort of half it with them. That's quite common, I think. Yeah.
I know. So
my problem with... I mean... Go on.
Yeah, it's the way I've always done things like Thought Bubble is to grab a table and then split it.
Yeah. Things like Thought Bubble, it's a lot easier. You know, I always share it with like Sean, my colorist, who's got his own book anyway, so it just sort of works out. You've got that sort of like mate with your table who'll keep you sane as well for those 2 days.
Yeah, someone to talk to at least, isn't it? I mean, my problem isn't with these sort of comic villages. It's and it's not really with MCM. My problem is comic conventions that declare that they're a Comic-Con and that they have that word in the title, but they are essentially just an autograph fair.
Yeah.
You know? And I think that's more common. I made a list. I was going to write an article about it last year, and I thought this is far too bitter of me. But there's a lot that's just come up. And without naming the convention, there was one earlier this year. And they sort of trailed our big guests coming, big female guests coming and all this sort of thing. And I signed up to the Facebook page. And it turned out to be Boyce's wife. From Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah.
I didn't expect that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I sort of was watching it all week thinking, oh, this would be good, you know, interesting, big guest coming. And I end up writing on the entry, look, this has made me want to kill myself. And I got banned off the Facebook page.
It's kind of, I don't know, Trey's description, if you're kind of saying, no, Comic-Con, there's no, not a single comic there.
I think people use it almost like just an adjective to describe the whole thing. Yeah. You know, it's yeah, I suppose with Comic-Con becoming less of a comic convention, you know, they can sort of say, oh, yeah, well, it's mostly guests and things like that are Comic-Con, isn't it? So, of course, we can describe it as this.
Wasn't someone trying to trademark that, one of the big boys?
Oh, yeah, San Diego was.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, if everyone at San Diego bought 10 comics, there'd be no problem with the industry, you know?
Yeah.
So what these people go and do, I don't know sometimes. You know, they go and get autographs of somebody who's in Vampire Diaries or some crap like that, you know?
I mean, not wanting to fire a shot at MCM. If the Comic Village wasn't there, would there be comics to sell?
Yeah. I'm not so sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, I remember going to the London Film and Comic Con when it was at Earl's Court a couple of years ago, and E.T.'s finger was there. Like, no word of a lie. The lady who played E.T.'s finger was there signing autographs.
Oh, my God.
Quid, and I thought, for fuck's sake.
And there wasn't a lot of comics there that year either, was there?
There wasn't.
In terms of dealers, I mean, we were quite disappointed. Did we end up going to another comic shop afterwards?
Probably. I remember the Hoff was there, wasn't he? The Hoff was there. That was good. And that midget from Game of Thrones, can you say little person, whatever, from Game of Thrones, he was there. That was exciting. But they were boxed off, so you couldn't even stare at them.
You just like staring at people. I just need to rewind a second. Are you telling me that someone played E.T.'s finger?
Yeah.
I can't believe you're going around claiming that and making money off of it.
Also, you must have really ugly fingers.
Yeah, that must have been... And that glowed. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's the impressive bit, though.
Yeah. A bit like Barney.
Yeah, maybe she... Does that glow?
I've never understood these people that kind of want, like, the background actor in, like, Star Wars Empire. Yeah. Like, he played Rebel, Snow Rebel 5.
Yeah.
And he's got 2 seconds of screen time.
The one I was talking about, the one that I got banned off the page for that one comment, there was people emailing to the or messaging on the page saying things like, I was in Empire Strikes Back, or, you know, I was, you know, a background player in X-Men 2 and stuff like that, you know, asking for a table, you know, and including a picture of them in, you know, Stormtrooper uniform and stuff like this. And I'm thinking, really, you know, where are the comics at this? You know, there was virtually nothing.
You know, I almost don't have a problem with people doing that because it's, you know, they're trying to make a living. But what I have a problem with is call it a film fair.
Film autograph fair. There's loads of them do it. You know what I mean? Yeah.
Yeah, but thankfully, as the sort of like the excitement and the culture is booming, we're getting like so many more awesome like smaller shows pop up, you know, like you know, Melksham, Nottingham, Leamington Spa, you know,
the lakes,
you know, like Cardiff Expo recently, you know,
WinterCon as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the list goes on and on. You know, it's ridiculous how many conventions there are.
I mean, I think it's great. We've got an industry that will support all those shows now. Because I can remember when it was, you know, Bristol was finding it hard to get people to come along.
Yeah, it was just Bristol for years, wasn't it? It really was.
Yeah. I miss Bristol this year. I still don't know why Bristol didn't happen this year. Does anyone know why it didn't happen?
Did it not happen at all? Did it? Or
no. I mean, I was looking forward because I launched the Red Mask at Bristol last year. So I because it was the first time I launched my comic. And it was like my local show. I thought, you know, go back. It's almost like, that'll be the home sort of show, if you know what I mean. But then, like, I just heard nothing. And it just, after a while, you just thought, well, it's not happening then, obviously.
Yeah. I know you couldn't buy on the door last year, could you?
No, and there were people desperate to go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that they saw a crazy thing to do.
And they tucked it away on, like, the third floor of a hotel. And it wasn't really signposted. You had to go up in a lift. There were still quite a lot of people sort of milling around. But it's another one of those classic cases of not necessarily signposting a show.
But I mean, that was a big deal. Bristol was a big deal for years. I remember talking to Cassada at it and Jim Lee and all these sort of people. You know, after UCAC, it was the big place every year, you know. Shame in it, really.
Yeah.
You know, but I think kids these days go, oh, let's go to Comic-Con, you know, and they're all over Instagram in their cosplay costumes and stuff like that. And they don't they don't necessarily sort of logically link it with the fact it's got anything to do with comics these days, you know.
Yeah.
It's all about the cosplay element. I mean, how many people did I see walking around in comics at MCM? Very few. Do you know what I mean? No one with a comic in their hand, I can certainly remember.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, you do see a lot of, I mean, I saw one cosplayer at Bristol, which I thought was genius, and she was clearly buying comics as well, because she was dressed up like a female Thor,
right.
Which is quite apt this year. You know, it would have been more apt, but, you know, she was ahead of the curve. But her hammer was sort of made out of, like, a shoebox, and whenever she bought comics, she opened up the hammer, put the comics in, and then closed it back up again. So it was like a bag.
That's good.
Yeah,
that's genius.
I was sat there just admiring, just thinking, you're a genius. You're absolutely genius.
There has been artists going on about the fact that cosplay has taken up space, but every time I've interacted with them at shows, they've always bought stuff. It's never been an issue.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So
that's good.
Some people get really put out, don't they? But, you know, I like marvelling at like how they put it all together. But
I mean, we can all sit here and go, "Oh, fucking cosplayers, idiots!" And then as soon as they turn up in a costume of someone you've created, you're like,
yeah.
"Cosplayers, brilliant!"
Yeah,
you know what I mean,
I know some lovely
cosplay.
Oh God, yeah, my head will explode, and you know,
yeah,
and it'll be their fault. So I'm not trying to put anyone off. I know some absolutely fantastic cosplayers, you know, and just the commitment that goes into it. But that's another conversation altogether.
Yeah,
but
Mark's quite fond of cosplayers, actually, Mark, aren't you?
Yeah.
Apparently so, Tony. Apparently so.
Well, I was. Shall I tell the story, Mark? I know you want me to. Don't
I? You? I've heard it many times.
we obviously being Zelig, the Zelig of comics. I just sort of sit at Mark's table in New York when we go, and he shares it with a guy called Brian Vander, who I think we've all spoken to on Twitter recently.
Yeah, Brian's a great bloke. Yeah.
Yes.
Great artist as well. Fantastic.
Yeah, very
artist.
Good. Yeah. Yeah. And Brian said to me, "Oh, Tony, do you want to come off and we'll find Sarah Pacelli? I want to get a commission with her." So I said, "Okay." So I said, "Mark, do you mind if we leave you on the table on your own?" And he sort of had a distant look in his eye. You know, it was like a dreamy looking into the near, you know, just staring off. I said, "Mark," he went, "Oh, sorry. So do you mind if we go off?" And he said, no, go on. And he seemed to be looking past me, you know, at something. So we walked past him. And as we walked past him, quite a large lady in a bikini painted in green paint. I'm going to call her Fat She-Hulk. That's what I'm going to call her.
God.
She walked past us, you know what I mean, with a little bit of a twinkle in her eye. Like she knew where she was going. She knew what she was up to, you know. She knew. And so we went off, we had a chat with Sarah Pacelli, super nice, you know, very, very nice lady, very talented lady. Came back and Mark's drawing, he's got his head down drawing. And I said, "Oh, look, I got this from Sarah Pacelli." And as he lifts his head, I see round his mouth, awful lot of green paint. I'm not drawing any conclusions about what happened in that 5 minutes I was away. But I think something sexy happened.
Mark, over to you.
You know what? That's the cleanest version I've heard of that story.
Well,
when we get Brian on, when we do our transatlantic podcast, he will thoroughly confirm that story, because I'll ring him first and tell him.
Yeah, that was also the show where every time I turned around and there was a cosplayer going past, Tony would go, "My mate wants a picture with you."
This is the new funny game. When you get a sort of bit of a crap cosplayer walking past, you shout at them, "Excuse me, can my friend have a picture?" Yeah, and then you get them to stand next to them while I take a picture. And I'm, "Oh, no, take another one. It's really good. Might be worth posting some on the Facebook page. That'd be good. Put some up."
We love cosplay on this show, by the way. We just want to say,
we do.
You know, we truly
Alex
appreciate
completely
it.
Spoiled it at
London
by getting the whole cast of Cats, didn't he?
He did, didn't he?
Wow.
That sounds amazing.
Just taking something, yeah.
Best picture ever. He loves it. He loves cosplayers. We all love them.
Yeah.
If we get cosplayers listening to the show, that's good. Can we be the cosplay podcast? We'll get loads of fucking numbers, won't we? It'd be brilliant.
Well, at Thought Bubble, I bumped into Star-Lord and Gamora came over to my table, had a bit of a lovely chat, and they walked off. And, you know, I had the natural, what came to my table didn't buy anything. The next day, they came back without their costumes and bought the red mask. So
brilliant.
Yeah.
Obviously, their characters couldn't buy the comic.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It would have been out of continuity.
Yeah, totally.
They've had to have a reboot.
Yeah, all new, all different cosplay.
Yeah. So if you listen out there, those two that bought the comic, I love you, and your cosplay was bloody ace. which it was actually. I'm not actually joking. You know, that was seriously good. Anyway, right to next gents. Oh, before I'm just going to interrupt this intermission to make a little announcement on my own. Speaking of the Red Mask, I've got it as part of a bundle, a digital bundle at the moment, which is my first foray into this kind of thing. And on Drive Through Comics, we just launched this week. There's the Freaks, Heroes, and Horrors bundle, which I'm sure if you search, you can find out. And Red Mask issue 1 and the Origin issue is part of it, as well as issues of 100% biodegradable. Have you heard of that?
Right.
I think you've heard of that. Yeah. Issues 1, 2, and 3 are part of that. Then they're anthology books worth checking out. Dark Matter, which is a sort of dark anthology, and the first issue of Good Guys. And you can get all of that for $3. I don't know what the conversion rate is, but you can get all of those issues. That's over 200 pages of comics awesome for 70% off. Now, I know I sound like a shill just selling it to people, but and it's available.
Yeah, Dark Matter is a great book as well as obviously Red Mask. But Dark Matter is done by some pals of mine who live about a mile from where I'm sitting now. Chris Sides does it. Really, really talented writer, and it's a great horror anthology.
Cool. Yeah.
So it's got a bit of everything, really. You know, you got sort of, because Good Guys. I don't know if anyone's read Good Guys. Has anyone read that yet?
No,
I've talked about it before.
It's an action-packed sort of sitcom that takes a sort of sideways swipe at society's like fixation on fame and stuff. And it's like sort of wannabe sort of superheroes, and they're desperate quest to become rich and famous, that kind of stuff. It's worth checking out. It's a great book, funny. So it's nice to be put the bundle I'm part of. I'm very proud to be part of. So definitely go on the Drive Through Comics and search for it. It's available until the end of July. And like I said, over 200 pages of comics for about $3 for you. So
well, let us know how that does do, because that's interesting. I see that coming up more and more often.
And it's certainly an interesting sort of way. I just want to get the name out there. I just want to get the book out there, and things like this are a great way to do it, as well as get to know some of the creators, because you'll sort of join up together to sort of like sell this thing. And you know, we've been throwing emails backwards and forwards, and everyone's just really great about it. But also, like, because I've just sort of dipped my toe into the digital comics realm, you know, and because the Origin is on there, sort of like it's one of those DRM you can pay whatever you want for it.
Right.
A lot of people have downloaded the Origin issue, but I haven't got any sort of real sort of conversion to sales of the individual issues yet. So I'm hoping that things like this just give it a bit of a kickstart. You know, if you like the first issue, then you know, move on from there.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think things like this are a good way to sort of go about it.
Yeah, so, definitely.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, cool. Yeah, shameless self promotion.
I think it will really help once you get your first trade together as well.
Yeah.
Because I think there is a slight wariness of folk to buy floppies, you know, whereas they, you know, if they can buy the whole thing in one go, they're a lot happier about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of small press doesn't get past the first one or two issues as well. And I think there's almost people are dubious to pick it up because they think, I mean, the amount of small press first issues I've got, that I've never gone anywhere after that, you know, either because they don't produce them or you never see the guy again or, you know, this sort of thing. I think having that trade just confirms that you're serious about it. I mean, we know you two guys are, but just confirms your seriousness about it, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And like, I've made a rod for my own back by saying my series is 5 issues. Do you know what I mean? So it's important for me that I commit and deliver on that. Yeah, I'll do the trade afterwards as well. But just because I'm old school and I like the individual issues as well, just to have those 5 sort of issues. You know, if no one bought it, I'd still have 5 comics that I've made off my own back. So, you know, just personal pride.
Yeah, I mean, it works for Red Mask. It really does work for that, because it's got that sort of Saturday morning feel to it, isn't it, as well, you know, sort of episodic. So yeah, definitely. Yeah,
that's thrown it open me, because I was kind of thinking, should he get all the individual issues or get it all in a trade? And I was kind of thinking the individual issues would be best, but obviously you guys are sending the trade, so oh, God knows.
Well, I mean, I just,
we're old and you, I'm just
think,
it, I
thinking somebody like Chris Doherty, do you know him at all? He did a book called Video Nasty, which was like a black and white. I think it was printed, but it had that look of a photocopied zine. And then when the book came out, it's a really nice package. And I think that did a lot better for him as soon as there was the finished book.
Okay.
Although it was great. great when you really. when you bought the individual issues. They did come in a plain brown envelope, which was kind of nice.
Old school.
Yeah, no, it's really really interesting book, all based around sort of video nasties, murder for video, and yeah. It really takes a turn about the further way, and you think, "Oh right, I see where he's going." Because he's got a very sort of simple style. I mean, it's a nice style, but it's sort of almost at odds with the sort of horror of the book. You know, if that is fair to say, it sort of it looks like something that's a sort of slice of life book, and then suddenly it takes a turn. You know,
yeah, it's super, really it's nice. Super dark, but it's really, really good.
When did that? What year did that come out? A
couple of years ago. Yeah,
a couple of years ago.
Yeah,
nice.
I'll grab the details off of that because I'll check that out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very good.
Well, yeah. it'll be in the links. You know me.
Yeah.
Anyway, gents, speaking of what we've been reading, shall we get some recommendations on the go?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Can we go?
Who wants to go first?
Shall I go?
Yeah, off you go.
Okay, Walks with Lulu, which I think I sent to Vince and Dan, didn't I? Did you have a look at it?
Yes, I did. Yeah.
I've not had a chance to look at that yet,
yeah.
No.
Lovely look at that.
Yeah, it's a sort of by a guy called girl called Elizabeth Quirstrit, I think is how you pronounce her surname. And over the last couple of years, she's put out a lot of sort of autobiographical comics. So it's just sort of slice of life, the sort of misadventures in her life, you know, sort of ordinary day to day stuff. But this is sort of fully coloured, fully painted, very sort of photorealistic stuff about just basically about her relationship with a dog that she borrows and walks. But it's sort of quite poignant in that. I mean, I'm a dog guy. I've got a dog, and I love taking him for a walk. And there is a sort of simpatico, a sort of codependency that grows out of your relationship with a pet, you know. And she sort of draws on that, and the improvement in both her life and the dog's life is sort of relevant to the story. And it's really really nice. You can find a copy at Quirstrit, which is Quirstrit.co.uk, and she's on Twitter at Quirstrit. Really talented lady, really, really interesting, poignant but funny, sort of poetical stuff. Really nice.
Oh, lovely. What about you, Dan?
It was my birthday on Friday.
And hey! Happy birthday, dude.
Cheers, thank you. I was fortunate to get some art books.
All right.
It's from, there's one like Batman from the Rocksteady games, which is just crammed with stuff. That's absolutely brilliant.
Is it and from all, the, one, all the Rocksteady games, or is it just the recent?
No, it's all three of them.
Oh, nice.
So it's interesting to see kind of how the art development within it's gone. And someone got me a DK version of like Batman's history, and it's kind of got from the first issue straight up to kind of like modern day. So that's our small press remit out the window.
well, no, it's recommendations. You can say whatever you want if you've been reading it. Yeah. It's
well worth it. Checking out.
Mark?
I'm going to tout something that doesn't really need touting, but I haven't seen it mentioned anywhere, which is Alan Moore's new book, Providence.
Oh, right. I really want to read this.
With Jason Burroughs. It's fantastic. It's the best thing he's done since From Hell. It's what you wanted Necromicon to be.
Yeah. And that's, wasn't. The first issue, I mean, I looked at it and it did look like one wordy mother, the first issue.
Oh, yeah, it's a proper read.
It's
you know, like From Hell was, you know. It's a sit down with a cup of tea, no distractions kind of read,
and it's very Lovecraftian and like it's based on. Oh,
it's completely Lovecraftian, and it's one of those ones where Alan Moore has gone away and researched absolutely everything you can think about Lovecraft and all the people he hung around with and all of the cults that sprung up around it and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, it just smacks of a book that's been really well researched, like From Hell was.
Mm. And Jason, did you say Jason Burroughs, his art was perfect for that kind of stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's got a really nice sort of almost Steve Dillon-esque look to it. So it's really clean and you know, it's great for the talking head stuff because obviously it's Alan Moore, so there's lots of that.
Mm.
And it's not fussy. It's just a really good book.
Is that black and white, is it, Markle?
No, it's coloured, tons of back matter as well. So, it's a $4.99 book, but you really feel like you're getting your...
It's similar to the Black Dossier, because there's loads of stuff with that. Like,
oh, yeah, I mean, there's tons of stuff. You've got sort of Alan Moore's notes, you've got stuff that relates to the story, letters and stuff. In fact, it almost doesn't explain itself, which is quite nice.
Yeah. Classic Lovecraft, you know, stuff that doesn't explain itself. I remember seeing, like, he had videos talking about how Lovecraft in modern sort of culture and stuff, you see, like, plushies and things like that, and he wanted to take it back to that whole, you know, almost make it scary again, you know, take it down.
Oh, yeah, he's definitely doing that. Yeah. I think this book is going to mess with your head. And I've not been the biggest fan of Alan Moore's output for about the last 10 years, but I took a punt on this, and it's really, really good.
There's a lady I work with who got that Neonomicon out from the library, and she ended up taking it back and complaining up to a certain point. And she said, have you read this? And I was like, yeah, I'm well aware of the
It's full of Barneys. There's Barneys everywhere.
Sky's full of Barneys.
Hashtag. That's the hashtag for this show, folks.
Also, Vince has done a cock.
No, Vince has done a cockney. Vince the cockney, not Vince has done a cock.
I've got it written down wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. God, you're
notebook. Lucky you're not doing the notes.
Thank God for that. Anyway, my recommendation for this week, folks, as I bring us back on track, A Midnight Man by Mo Alley and Andy Bloor. Who here's checked that out?
I have. I love it. Yeah, really nice. Yeah.
Fantastic.
Happy lead to Mo as well, because I saw him posting about it the other day.
Yeah. They're constantly sort of, well, classic small press stuff. You've got to push it, haven't you? But Midnight Man is well worth checking out. It's a crazy story. Crazy story. I mean, it starts with, like, someone... Midnight Man sort of falling from Big Ben while being chased by a possessed horse from the American Civil War. And if you don't want to buy it after that sentence, then something's seriously wrong with you.
It's a little bit of Vendetta, I found it as well. A little bit of sort of...
Yeah, it's very sort of... There's sort of vigilantism, but with time travelling, and, like, there's so many sort of layers and different things going on. And, you know, I'm good mates with Andy, and his artwork is just off the chain on this stuff. And I saw some of the original pages as well, you know, and I told him, like, I picked out one of the pages and said, don't get rid of that one because I want it. There's this beautiful sort of rich blacks and, like, you know, sort of hyper detailed, and, you know, he puts a lot of work into the backgrounds and stuff as well. I mean, it's black and white, but because of the way he colours it, you know, it's like flat colours, but the way his artwork sort of means that the flat colours almost... they have layers. It seems like there's more shading than there is. You know, it's the story will drive you crazy. You know, it's all over the shop, and, like, in a good way.
It was like 80s small press. It was like you could see it in maybe Warrior magazine, even something like that. It's got that sort of darkness about it.
Totally. It's got that sort of, classic sort of, like, British sort of feel as well. You know, it just sort of bleeds off the pages. Well worth checking out. You can get it from midnightman.bigcartel.com. Mo Alley and Andy Bloor, they're working on a follow-up, Andy's told me that Mo's story is absolutely insane. So that's always good. Stay tuned to Midnight Man, because I want more of it. I want to try and get as much of it as I can. So there's that. Thank you for joining us tonight, Mark.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Hopefully we haven't put you off socialising with people from the outside world too much.
No. I went out the other day. I've seen people recently, so it's okay.
And now he's back in the cave.
We saw Ant-Man yesterday.
We did. It was great.
Oh, I love Ant-Man. Yeah.
Loved it. Yeah.
There's a billion podcasts and websites you can check out that talk about Ant-Man. Let's just put it like this. It's ace. It's awesome.
Yeah. Can I just say hello to Alex, Alex Martin, who's a pal of mine, and Mark's, whose birthday is on Tuesday.
Yeah, happy birthday, Alex.
Happy birthday, Alex.
And to Matt, who texted me this morning saying he's really enjoying the show, Matt Harrower, who's a fellow artist, writer, character, who I'm working on a book with at the moment. So, yeah, he's a good lad.
He was one of my ex-students.
Yeah.
Hey.
Don't hold that.
So he suffered me teaching, which is even better.
Does that mean he's not going to listen to this episode? Oh, no, not Mr. Lamming. Oh, no.
Not that bastard Mark.
Yeah. Anyway, folks, hope you enjoyed the show. And if you, like, as always, let us know what you think and what you want us to talk about. And there's several ways you can get in contact with us. You can email us on awesomecomicspod@gmail.com. You can follow us on the Twitter at
The Awesome Pod. We've got a Facebook page, Facebook.com/AwesomeComicsPodcast. And you can also get all the episodes on both iTunes, which we're on iTunes now. Hey, we're in the modern world. Yeah. Yeah, put some enthusiasm into it, boys. And you can also catch us on awesomecomics.podbean.com. Now, where can you follow us individually on Twitter? Dan.
At Vanguard Comic.
Tony.
At EzOYZ, which is EzOHYZ. I think it's also worth saying, if you've got a small press book that's coming out and you fancy us idiots having a look at it, then write on our Facebook page, or you've got the email, write into us, and we'd love to see anything small press you've got coming out.
Yeah, definitely. Let's get some interaction on that Facebook page. Woohoo! And, and where can people follow you, Mark? Not in real life. We don't want people following you around.
His address is... Yeah, phone number.
You can follow me on Twitter, and it's at monkey_mark with a C rather than a K, and you can find me on there. I'm probably most active there, although I think there's a Monkey Mark Instagram as well, which gets stuff posted up on it as well.
And Mark, you were telling me you're quite active on Tinder at the moment. If you
want to. Absolutely, and Match.com.
Yeah, so find it there.
Oh dear, what a bag full of Barneys we are. And on that rather disgusting note, thank you for joining us this week, folks. From Mark, Tony, Dan, and myself. Stay tuned next week and stay awesome.
See ya.
Bye.
Bye.